Welcome to It's True or Is It? A podcast that mixes fact and fiction, then tries to sort them out again. Your hosts are Michael Pryor and George Ivanov.
Hello and welcome to It's True or Is It? The podcast in which we try to convince you that certain facts are facts when in fact they're fibs, interspersed with facts that are actually facts. And you need to try to work out which is which. That's a very long and complex introduction. Hello, my name is George Ivanov.
And I'm Michael Pryor. George, I understood every word of it. So let me try to paraphrase. So we will present three stories each on a particular topic, two of which are true, one of which is false. And neither of us knows what we're going to hear.
You see, that's much more understandable and concise than what I rabbited on about.
Well, what's our topic for today, George?
Our topic is Australia, mate.
Ah, it's so good mate. That we come home with this sort of stuff. And so we've ploughed the pages of history. We've done our research on the geography, the culture, the land that we know as Australia. And we've come up with three mighty facts.
Oh, yes, we have.
George, would you like to start us off today?
All right. Well, you have a choice. I can talk about the quintessential Australian thing, poisonous snakes, or I can talk about something that might not seem to have any connection to Australia at first at all, and that is Skylab.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can talk about Thylactos plummetus, more commonly known as the drop bear.
Sounding very, very scientific there with that last one. So, yeah, put a bit of science in something. I'm already half convinced. Which one should we start with? Let's start with the last one, the bear.
Drop bears. Okay. So we've all heard of drop bears, these large carnivorous koala creatures with sharp teeth and razor-like claws that drop from the high branches of the eucalyptus trees onto unsuspecting tourists and proceed to devour them. It is probably one of Australia's best-known falsity. The creature supposedly invented to scare tourists.
Exactly. And whenever we talk about drop bears to tourists, we do it with a straight face.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm. So they've been part of Australian popular culture for a while now. And I thought this would be really interesting to do a little bit of digging into.
Okay.
And I discovered that they only really made it into the pop culture scene in the 1980s.
That recent?
That recent, yes. And in fact, their first mention in a newspaper came in 1982 in the Canberra Times.
Mm-hmm.
Often the person who is credited with popularising the notion of drop bears is actually Paul Hogan.
Okay.
Because in the early 80s, on his sketch comedy show, The Paul Hogan Show, he actually did a sketch in which an Indiana Jones-type character was attacked by a drop bear falling from a eucalyptus tree. So he's often credited with you know, kind of popularising the notion of drop bears. However, stories of drop bears existed all the way back into the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
and they were a very popular, scary campfire story in scout troops.
Hmm.
So I did a little bit of digging and discovered that this is where the myth of drop bears first originated. It was with the scouts going camping in the Australian bush. And there was one particular encounter with a cantankerous koala that got exaggerated into the mythology of drop bears. So I don't have an exact date for this. This is all very sketchy, but it was sometime in the mid to late 1970s where one poor Boy Scout was attacked by a vicious, some would suspect rabid, koala. He apparently brought it on himself, though.
Oh, can't imagine that.
climbing into a eucalyptus tree in order to try and give the koala a little bit of a cuddle because they're cute and furry.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was rewarded with a vicious swipe of its claws and ended up in hospital. The damage from the koala was actually fairly minimal and didn't actually send him to hospital. What sent him to hospital was the fact that he broke his arm when he fell from the tree. So surprised was he at getting swiped by a
poetic
vicious
justice,
koala.
Really.
Yeah. Was the koala actually rabid? Probably unlikely. But it did go him. And this got retold around the campfire. Exaggerated, and eventually became the drop bear that we now so love in Australian popular culture.
Well, 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 the origin, the true origin of the drop bear. This is what you're claiming, George.
Yes, yes, the true origin of the drop bear.
So I've got to ask myself, would scouts or schoolboys do something stupid? Yeah, well, that is entirely plausible. But the connection between schoolboy stupidity, drop bears, Paul Hogan, it's a potpourri of plausibility so far. So I'll park that one and we'll see where we go. I'm rolling out a bit of geography to start with here. And this is the true fact, absolutely true fact, that Australia has the second longest coastline of any country in the world, after Canada.
Geography is not my strong point. I'm trying to picture Canada on a map as compared to Australia.
Now, this is a thing that Canada, big country, but it's not an island like Australia. So Australia's got that whole circumference. But where Canada wins is that it's a big country, but it's got lots and lots of Arctic islands, and they're all included in the count.
Oh, so each island is its own
coast. It's part of Canada.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so, that kind of makes sense.
All right. So
we've got islands too.
We do, but not as many as Canada. They really have hundreds and hundreds up there.
I did not know this.
So there we go. Now, before you really leap into making judgment on this, I need to point out an extraordinary, I suppose this is a sub fact, that we really don't know how long a coastline is, thanks to what's called the coastline paradox. Now, the Sketchplanations website says this. This is a fascinating observation that it's not straightforward to say how long a coastline is. If you were to measure the coastline of a country by using a ruler on a globe, you'd come out with a vastly different number than if you were to pace around the edge of that coastline.
Because they'd be all crinkly.
The closer you look, the more wiggles and squiggliness you come across. And instead of converging on a more accurate length, the coastline just keeps getting longer the closer you measure it. The smaller your ruler, the longer it gets. Now, in other words, it's all fractals. It's fractals all the way down when you think of coastlines.
Wouldn't it also depend on whether the tide was in or out?
I think most countries, they establish a shoreline that the legal shoreline. That's yes. I hadn't thought of that actually, George, but no, there is an actual line that they take that is their coast.
Okay.
So that's my fact. Number one, that Australia has the second longest coastline of any country in the world after Canada. So think of all of the countries that are in the world, think of all of their coasts and islands, and Australia, being a big country, does get up there because of its islandiness. It is a great big island. Not many other countries are a continental island like Australia is.
Okay.
All right then. So that's one for you to ponder move on.
It has the air of plausibility.
Certainly does. That's the way we write them.
What do you want? Do you want Skylab?
Skylab sounds good. Skylab.
Skylab.
We're talking about the satellite, Skylab.
Yes, the space station.
Yep.
Yeah.
From, you tell me.
Yeah, okay. 1973. In fact, May 14th, 1973 was when it was launched on an unmanned Saturn V rocket. So it was America's first space station, and it was certainly the biggest space station of to date. Lots of records were broken. Lots of science was scienced. And it eventually, its orbit began to deteriorate, mm-hmm. and it was abandoned. And in 1979, Skylab fell from the skies into Earth's orbit. Now, vast majority of it did burn up Earth's orbit, but little bits of it did drop down and make it to Earth, specifically in Western Australia.
Oh.
And very specifically on a town called Esperance.
All right, yeah.
So the thing is that the town council, upon gathering the little bits of Skylab that fell on it, decided that this was a bit of a nuisance, and so they sent a fine to NASA for $400 for the cleanup of their property from the town.
Like space littering.
Yes. NASA, unsurprisingly, ignored the littering fine and never paid it. The council at the time wrote it off as a bad debt. I don't think they ever really expected NASA to fork up. But it did eventually get paid, although not by NASA.
Okay.
So what happened was, for the 30th anniversary of the fall of Skylab in 2009, the town decided to get a little bit of publicity out of all of this, and it put up billboards all around the town saying that NASA had never paid its fine.
NASA owes us money.
Yeah. This did get some huge publicity around the world at the time, and came to the ears of a radio station host in America, a guy named Scott Barley of California's Highway Radio.
Okay.
And he decided that he just could not let this stand. He couldn't have America in debt to Australia. So he ran an appeal on his radio show, raised the $400 needed, and paid the fine. So the fine got paid, the billboards got removed, but it wasn't NASA. NASA never forked over the money.
Okay. So a number of parts of that all have to come together for it to be an absolute true fact. One, Skylab crashed in West Australia. Two, that the town of
Esperance
fined NASA. And three, 30 years later, a radio station paid the fine.
Mm.
A lot of moving parts there, George.
There are indeed.
Okay. All right. Into consideration it goes. I'll launch then straight into my second piece. I'm having a nice pithy fact here that I'll roll up to you, then I'll embellish it a little bit more. And the fact is that Australia has only produced one serious commercial crop, the macadamia nut. Macadamia nut is a native Australian nut, and it is the only serious wide-scale commercial crop. Now, when you think about other countries and other parts of the world, some of the staple foods we eat have come from there. So much of the wheat and the chickpeas and all of those staples grew up in the fertile crescent around the Euphrates River. And then Asia has presented the West with so much food. Many citrus fruits originated in that part of the world. And then when Columbus went over to what they called the New World, brought back potatoes, sweet potatoes, chili, tomatoes, things that are staple for us today. Australia has only produced one thing, and that is the macadamia nut. Every other plant we grow for food, oil or cloth comes from other parts of the world. So, bit of background about the macadamia. Macadamia was first planted commercially in Australia in 1888. In 1910, commercial plantations of macadamias began in Hawaii, USA. For quite some time, they were better known as Hawaii nuts.
Oh, really?
And the Australian origin of them was totally obscured, especially in the United States. Oh. Even today, some people find it hard to understand or accept that they came from Australia. And in 2012, South Africa became the biggest producer of macadamia nuts. So we've fallen behind even there. In the one thing that we originated, we are not the world's biggest supplier of.
That is a real shame, actually.
It is.
Coincidentally, the macadamia nut is my favourite nut.
Oh, mine too, like by a considerable margin too.
Excellent. Especially coated in dark chocolate.
Yes. Mm. Oh, yeah. I have a little ritual every Christmas after everything has settled down after the enormous Christmas lunch that I'll take myself off somewhere and sit down with some macadamia nuts, roasted, very lightly salted, and a glass of liqueur muscat.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that is my Christmas treat to myself. So there we go. The macadamia nut is Australia's only commercial scale crop.
Wow. That does have a ring of authenticity to it. I can't think of why that would be untrue.
Mm-hmm. Can you think of any other?
No, well, I can't.
There we go.
No, see, I can't.
See, here's where I could roll out and say to you that if I was trying to fake you, I'd say, well, yeah, George, you overlooked the banana is totally Australian in origin. Or is it? I'm clouding your mind here.
I don't think it is.
It's actually from Papua New Guinea, but there we go.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that.
So it's time to talk about Australia's deadly snakes.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this. Who doesn't love a venomous snake?
Well, indeed. There are over 2,900 species of snakes worldwide, and well over 100 of them are in Australia. About 66 of Australia's snakes are venomous, causing, you know, anything from severe discomfort to imminent death. Now, I'm saying about 66 because I couldn't find a definitive answer to this, and different sources will give me slightly different figures on this. And some of the more reputable sources also tend to use the word about.
Yeah, and some of these snake researchers, of course, you can't get in touch with them because they're dead.
Sorry, I needed a moment to recover there. Okay, so we've got lots of venomous snakes, and we also happen to have 10 of the world's deadliest snakes living here in
Australia.
Yes, we've got the eastern brown snake, the western brown snake, the tiger snake, the inland taipan, the coastal taipan, the king brown snake, lowland copperhead, small-eyed snake, common death adder, and red-bellied black snake.
Death adder.
What is there an uncommon death?
Yeah, it's common. Yeah, common death. It's just everywhere.
The naming of some of these things gets to me, and which is what I'm going to talk about here today, because I'm going to focus in on the king brown snake, also known as the mulga snake. So it can grow up to 2.7 metres in length, and it is extremely venomous. Mm. So a bite from one of these will cause swelling, bruising, and quite a bit of pain around the area of the bite. They will also cause muscle damage, kidney damage, and will stop your blood from clotting.
Okay, so don't mess around with a king brown.
No, so they're fairly nasty. And if you do get bitten by one, you need to get some anti-venom, you know, relatively quickly. The problem is that the king brown snake is not a brown snake.
Okay.
It is part of the black snake family, not the brown snake family.
Okay.
So getting brown snake anti-venom, if you've been bitten by a king brown snake, is not the thing to do.
Oh,
you need to
match
get
the venom.
Oh yeah, yeah. With snakes, you generally have to match the snake to the anti venom. So in family groups, so there is a brown snake anti venom and there is a black snake anti venom. But if you get bit by a king brown snake, you need black snake anti venom.
They really got to rename this snake.
Yeah, of course, I mean, if you're not sure by what you have been bitten because it's run away too quickly, you can get a polyvalent anti-venom, which isn't as good as having a specific anti-venom, but, better than nothing.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people don't want to go chasing after the snake that's already bit them once to find out what it is. But, yeah, no, the big thing here is that the king brown snake is not a brown snake, even though it's brown.
That is an interesting fact there, and potentially a really important fact for you to have up your sleeve.
A very important. Well, one presumes that if you go to a hospital and say, I've been bit by a king brown snake, that the staff will know that it's not a brown snake, that it's a black snake and requires black snake antivenom.
So the one of the many implications of this is that hospitals have to have racks of different antivenoms so that they can quickly go, yep, it's this one.
My understanding is that not every hospital will keep the whole range of antivenoms, that it tends to be by location.
Yeah.
So, because not every location will have a proliferation of a particular type of snake. So
geographically,
But most of them will keep a polyvalent snake venom on hand and mm-hmm. then the snake venom for the snakes that are particular to their region.
My cat got bitten by a snake a few years ago.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, it was very serious. We came out one morning and he was not his usual perky self. Mm. And he was slumped in the corner and couldn't rouse him in any way. And after some taking to the vets and tests and so on, they concluded, yes, it's been bitten by a snake. And it was probably too late to administer antivenom. But I said, please administer antivenom. They said that cats are pretty remarkable. And if they get bitten by a snake, what they do is they hunker down. They sort of, they stop moving. And
stops the spread of the venom.
And they process it, and most cats recover.
Wow, really?
Dogs are different. Mm. Dogs get bitten by a snake, according to the vet I was talking, and the dog runs around in circles and go, I've been bitten by a snake. Quick, quick, help me. Catch me and take me to the vet. Oh, I'm running away.
Because dogs are stupid.
And it pumps. We know dogs are stupid in the nicest possible way, but it pumps the venom right through their bodies, and it's often fatal.
That's why you hear about lots of dogs dying from snake bite and you never really hear about cats.
Yeah, yeah. This is a general principle, of course. Mm. And if your cat or dog gets bitten by a snake, you hope that it's a young snake or a snake that's recently been biting a whole lot of other things and doesn't have much venom. But Winston the cat, he recovered and he no lasting effects. And after many thousands of dollars of vet bills, come back to us and has been a good boy and hasn't tackled a snake since then that we know of.
Well, I'm glad to hear that he made a recovery.
All right, George. Now,
your last one.
Yes, I'm still thinking about venomous snakes and King Brown. But my very first story that I rolled out today was about Australia having the second longest coastline. And I'm going into second place again with this story. And I'm going to say that the second largest sapphire, gem sapphire, in the world was found in Australia.
I didn't think Australia was known for its sapphires.
There we go. Oh, listeners, I'm onto a winner here. So the Black Star of Queensland, also known as the Brimstone of Queensland, named after its nature and place of origin, is a 733-carat, which is 150 gram black sapphire. And it was the world's largest gem-quality star sapphire until the Star of Adam was discovered in Sri Lanka in 2015. In 1938, a 12-year-old boy named Roy Spencer plucked an unusual grey stone from the hillside near Anarchy in Queensland. He showed his dad, Harry Spencer, a struggling miner who lived in a dusty shack with his family in Queensland, and he identified his son's half-pound stone as a large black crystal and propped it up against the back door, where it served as a doorstep for 9 years before a visiting jeweller, gem buyer, said, I'll have a bit of that, and took it off, and it was polished up and became the second largest sapphire gem in the world.
Did that family receive any money, or did that gem person go, oh, look, I'll give you a couple of hundred for it?
You hear this story again and again in the world of gemstones, that the original finder is some local lad, some poor, impoverished miner, and they are inevitably exploited by the next person in the chain, who is inevitably exploited in the next person and the next person. So these things often wind up in huge multinational jewellers like Tiffany's, or in the front of a casino or something like that, showing up. And the last purchasers paid many, many millions for it. Yeah, and the person who discovered it in the first place would be thinking, yes, if only.
Mm.
So the second largest sapphire in the world was discovered in Australia.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one.
Ladies, gentlemen, gentlefolk out there, now comes the time where we have to
choose.
We have to choose, we have to judge, we have to state which one we think is fake out of the three that we presented to each other.
So, remind me and our dear listeners.
I will remind you that the very first fact that I posited was that Australia has the second longest coastline of any country in the world after Canada.
Still doesn't quite seem plausible.
The second fact I maintain is 100% true is that the macadamia is the only commercial scale crop, food crop, crop of any sort that has come from Australia, that is native to Australia.
I can believe that one. I'll say that one right now. That's a true one.
The third is the one that I just let everybody know about, the sapphire. The black star of Queensland was the second largest, this huge hunk of gem quality sapphire.
Now, you see, if you'd chosen opal, then I would have definitely believed you. But sapphire, I'm not sure. So it comes down to either sapphire or coastline. In both cases, the second biggest. But which second biggest?
I got stuck on twos. Not the best, not the most, but second best, second most.
I'm going to say the sapphire is the incorrect one, is the fib in amongst the facts.
George, I would have believed it if I had presented it to me, but it's totally true.
Bugger.
Yep. The Black Star of Queensland was the largest gem quality sapphire in the world. Now, it's not appreciated, but Australia has huge sapphire fields in and around Anarki in Queensland.
I did not know that.
Now, they're a particular sort of sapphire. When we think of sapphires, we think of this blue star, like a diamond ring, but blue, sparkling. Mm. But star sapphires are different. They are cut sort of like in a little dome, and they display this gorgeous star. The light hits it, and a five-pointed star radiates over the surface, and they're gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. Look them up, listeners. You'll soon see how star sapphires differ from those other sapphires. But we have lots of them, and just like the opal fields in Coober Pedy, we have these sapphire fields up in Queensland. Little known, little understood. So that means that, of course, the fake was that, coastline.
Coastline. Yeah, I should have gone with the coastline.
Let me read to you, George, the true ladder of coastline, that the top longest coastline in the world is indeed Canada. So there we go. There's the ploy, isn't it? You add a little bit of truth and it can start to make things sound a bit truthier. Second, do you want to have a guess which country actually is the second longest coastline in the world?
Iceland?
Norway. Mm. You were in the right part of the world. Mm. Now, I think Norway's not a big country, but it's all of those fjords, I think. Yeah, you have to measure all of those. Number three is Indonesia. Yep, big country, lots of islands. Four is Russia. Big country. Five is the Philippines. Again, lots of islands. Number six is, surprisingly, Japan. Seven, Australia. Yay, we come number seven. Number eight is USA. Number nine, New Zealand. Number 10 is China. So there we go. There's the top 10 coastlines in the world.
And again, I'm going to have to bring this back to pop culture, as I invariably do. And, of course, we all know that the fjords of Norway were designed according to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Slarty Bartfast.
Slarty Bartfast was very good at fjords. All right, George. Now, remind me of your three.
Right. So we had drop bears, the origin of drop bears. Mm. We had Skylab dropping on Australia. Oh, look, we had theme going here, things dropping in Australia from drop bears to Skylab. And then, of course, finishing with the brown snake that isn't a brown snake.
George, sometimes in the episodes that we've done so far, sometimes there's a story that jumps out as obviously untrue. And they usually turn out to be true. But your three, they're all of, how can I say, feels like an equal level of plausibility here, which makes it very difficult to choose between them. I'm going to go drop bears. Mainly, now your point isn't that drop bears are true.
No. They're totally make-believe. It's like where the idea
origin of them, the whole notion. And your origin story?
A vicious attack on a Boy Scout.
Vicious attack on a Boy Scout.
Who thoroughly deserved it.
Well, yes, who hasn't wanted to viciously attack it? I'm going to stick out my neck and say, yes, I believe that is untrue with no level of certainty.
And you would be absolutely correct.
Nailed it.
Yes. Okay. I did couch it in a lot of truth. The first mention was in the Canberra Times in 82. Paul Hogan is often credited with bringing it to the popular consciousness. And it was a popular campfire story amongst Boy Scouts.
I can remember.
But the idea that that whole incident with the precocious lad up in the tree getting swiped by a koala is completely fictitious.
But plausible.
Well, obviously not that plausible since you managed to pick it.
It's a level of plausibility, though, isn't it? It was just slightly less plausible than the other two. That's all.
But, yeah, the other two are really interesting ones. I love the Skylab story. It's my favourite. Well, no, one of my two favourite Australia stories, the other one being about Western Australia seceding, but I'd already used that in another episode, so I couldn't reuse it.
I must say that the Skylab story is my favourite story where satellites crashed to the Earth in Australia story. It's certainly my favourite of those.
I just think it sums up Australia and America so well. You know, Australia, it's like, you littered on our town. And here's a fine. And America going, we're going to ignore you.
Yeah, and Australia knowing that it's a joke. Yeah. Doing it tongue-in-cheek and having a lend, but with a totally straight face, and then America just not getting it.
Mm.
Yep, that's the way it is. And I think we've come up to the end of this episode of It's True or Is It, George?
Well, given that we've run out of facts, yeah.
And from now, we'll be busily putting some facts and falsities together for our next episode.
Yes, the topic of which I can't remember offhand. We've even decided.
We've got the topics all organised, listeners out there.
Yes, they're all organised. Yes, we know exactly what we're talking about.
You can believe us. And so we will say goodbye.
Oh, no, we won't.
Oh, no, we've got something else, George?
Yeah, I just want to quickly plug another book because, of course, I wrote The Australia Survival Guide, which is the first in my series of kids' non-fiction books.
An excellent book it is, too. Listeners out there, make sure you go and grab yourself a copy, and not just one for yourself. Buy a few extra copies to give away to friends and family.
Always a good idea.
And before next episode, it'd probably be a really good idea to subscribe and like this podcast and look for us on social media where we'll be plugging it all over the place.
Oh, yes, plug.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael Pryor.
And goodbye from me, George Ivanov.
And join us next time.